to the fire. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation here on the Sam Nation Radio Network. It is Friday morning, the 14th of September. And Hurricane Florence has made landfall. Now, I think part of the story here, iconic imagery of the nearing hurricane yesterday, as it was nearing the North Carolina coast, were images from a webcam high atop the Frying Pan Tower. Now, this place, if you're not familiar with it, is a little tiny outpost, a former lighthouse that's been decommissioned. It's about, I want to say it's about 30 miles, 39 miles southeast of Southport, North Carolina. So just off the North Carolina coast. And I think structurally the closest thing to the hurricane as it was coming. And they've got this webcam up, and the webcam was trained on the American flag, on an American flag that was getting increasingly tattered as the winds came down upon it. So I think I last checked it last night. Producer Robbie and I doing a little bit of show prep. We were looking at it, and the webcam was just shaking violently. The hurricane had not yet reached it, and this morning the webcam is down. So there it is. By the time the hurricane made landfall, this is Hurricane Florence. I know the FEMA director used the wrong name for the hurricane. Press is having a field day with that. So when you're a FEMA director and you're preparing for your first big natural disaster, because that's what this guy's, you know, all eyes right now politically. There's a story to this, right? It's not just the lives affected, but everybody wants the Trump administration, at least over at CNN and MSNBC, to fail. And failure for them is widespread misery and suffering. That is, of course, the fault of FEMA, and that being Trump and his cronies. So the Trump guy, his name is Brock. He's out there, and he's talking about preparedness, and he uses the wrong name for Hurricane Florence. And all hell breaks loose because, of course, he doesn't even know what hurricane's coming. But if you're the FEMA director, this is your first natural disaster, what are you doing? You're spending day in, day out examining past storms. What happened? What didn't happen? What went right? What went wrong? And I don't know about you, but all these names, you throw 50 different hurricanes at me, and I'm going to get a little confused in the head. By the way, that's if a hurricane hits the South, is it a hurricane or a hurricane? I will use the two interchangeably here today on the show. All right. So now the hurricane has made landfall, and I will exactly right now tell you what the news will be this week. First of all, the storm was downgraded by the time it hit the shore. Was downgraded from a Category 4 to a Category 1 storm. Don't be fooled by this. This is still a huge deal. Category 1, 90-mile-an-hour winds. Yesterday, Robbie, when we were looking at the frying pan, you remember what it said for winds? It was like 35 miles an hour. And the whole thing was shaking. It looked like it was going to blow over. 90-mile-an-hour wind is still, it's still out of this world. And that's not the real threat in these storms. And I have to give a little bit of background. I recognize that much of our audience is Southern California based. So there's two things here that we as Californians don't realize about these storms. One is it's really not about the wind. The wind's terrible. I agree. But what comes afterwards is the water. And some of this is a storm surge from the ocean. But another part of it is just massive amounts of rainfall. They're expecting, and as Southern Californians, this is really tough to grasp this concept, but they're expecting up to 4 feet of rain. 4 feet. What do we get that in a decade? Do you even know what that looks like? The other thing that we don't realize is that it's humid. It's hot and humid. It's 90 degrees sometimes after these storms. 90, there was one storm, Fran? Hurricane Fran was 97 degrees after Hurricane Fran. So we see these pictures, I think, here in Southern California. We see these pictures, we see rain. Typically here, a rainy day is what? A cold day, right? It's cold and rainy. But this rain comes with a tremendous amount of water, tremendous amount of moisture, right? That's a storm surge coming from the ocean if you're coastal. And on top of that, you've got this blistering heat. So what happens? What type of crises are created beyond just structural damage? You know, buildings that are, you know, shattered and you know, trees that are across the road and whatnot. The next thing that occurs in these natural disasters is, you know, power is out. It's hot as hell. You got water. So you've got fungus growing. You've got the food in your refrigerator is spoiling. Everything's going to hell. You're hot. You've got, and it's really the days after when the storm blows over that things are especially bad. Now, the expectation, and this just boils me. It doesn't matter if it's not a political issue. I mean, it is a political issue, but for me, it's not a party issue. I don't care if this hurricane happens under Obama or under Trump. In my view, the idea that the federal government is totally and absolutely responsible for your lack of planning, for your lack of preparedness, and for your stubbornness not to leave a disaster area blows my mind. I don't get it. And what I, well, that's why the news coverage this next week is going to be so frustrating. Now, I know it's going to be frustrating because, well, you know, because it already started before the storm even hit. Andrea Mitchell talking about Puerto Rico, because this is what they were, you know, they were talking about. They're talking about Katrina. They're talking about Puerto Rico and the terrible, you know, Trump in Puerto Rico. I mean, he just let those Puerto Ricans die. And where is this going? Why did Trump not care about the Puerto Ricans? Well, here we have, again, Brock Long, he's the FEMA administrator, talking to Andrea Mitchell. And Mitchell's going after Brock Long on this idea of infrastructure and whose responsibility it is to take care of it. Listen to this stunning exchange.
Just as after Katrina, where there was terrible infrastructure in parts of New Orleans, that is a federal responsibility. These are American citizens.
You're actually wrong on that. It's not a federal responsibility to upkeep the infrastructure. Actually, most of the infrastructure in this company is owned by the private sector. FEMA doesn't control the maintenance of the infrastructure. And if you remember, when I went back for the third supplemental after Congress, I had to ask for special authorities. It's never been done before to fix the deferred maintenance or the infrastructure that was allowed to run.
Okay. And I got to apologize because sometimes my mind gets a little bit ahead of my mouth. And I already was skipping ahead to Puerto Rico because Puerto Rico, I've got a great example of this that I witnessed with my own eyes. When did the storm hit Puerto Rico? When was that? Well, I was there many months later in November of 2017. And we landed at a little airport on a side of the island that's used primarily by the military. It's used by FedEx and it's used by some local carriers. And this little airport, the most stunning thing is there was a private terminal. You want to talk about infrastructure? There was a So it was September 16th that the storm hit. Okay, so I was there, let's say, a month and a half afterwards. The trailer that Customs was in, the federal government, right, that building still didn't have power. It still had missing pieces on the roof. When we were trying to clear Customs, they actually couldn't boot up the computers, and they had to do something called a declaration entry where they can't really even verify if your passport's real. I'd never experienced something like that in all my years of international flying and travel. So anyway, that's the federal government. The hangar that we landed at was missing most of its roof. There was rainwater coming into the hangar. Last I checked, that's not how hangars work. Next door, And maybe you remember me talking about this on air when this happened, because it was such an experience. Next door is a giant FedEx facility. You all know who FedEx is. Well, that FedEx facility, I found out, had the hell knocked out of it in the wind. Well, guess which facility had a brand spanking new, clean, great roof? Everything done, fixed, organized, ready to go. Well, it was FedEx. I don't want to give anything away. And why? Well, that's an example of a private company taking care of itself. And they did it faster than the feds could with their own facility that presumably matters somewhat. You know, maintaining foreign, you know, immigration controls. And they can't even bring power into that facility. This is an example of what happens in these sort of, we expect the government. We've got our private property. You got a house, you got an apartment, maybe you've got, you know, whatever, a restaurant, business, whatever it is. And the storm comes and you expect the federal government that can barely take care of itself to come in and help you. Good luck. And by the way, this problem is a problem no matter who's president. I don't care if it's Bush. I don't care if it's Obama. Storms come and go. Okay. And it's ultimately, you know that you live in an area where these storms are going to happen. This is the same thing in California. What are you going to do? Build your house out of adobe? And then cry to FEMA that it fell on your head when a magnitude 8.3 earthquake hit. No. Built your house on a fault line. Build it well. Take care of yourself. Take out the proper insurances. So that's part of the story. The other part of it, of course, is the emergency response. And we know with Puerto Rico, one of the iconic imagery, of course, and Katrina, too. You, everybody trying to get in supplies. The idea of the bare shelves in the stores. And this here actually is an issue that I think is so interesting. And that is, why are those store shelves bare? And why in God's name can we in a market-driven economy not deliver supplies? Why are we talking about the federal government coming in, the National Guard, if you're dealing with the state, coming in and being the sole purveyor of goods necessary to sustain a population? Don't we have something called a market economy? Well, we don't. Not exactly. Not when it comes to disasters. We have something, and what is it, 30 plus states in this country have something called anti-gouging laws. Now, these are stories that are going to come out over and over and over again. These anti-gouging laws are designed by politicians who rely on stupid people voting them in. Because to generally stupid people, the idea of gouging sounds very bad. What is gouging? Gouging is what? Raising prices unconscionably? Raising prices at a time when people are vulnerable, right? These are kind of words that come to mind or descriptions that come to mind when you think of gouging. The New York Times put out a piece yesterday I thought was quite interesting. Hurricane price gouging is despicable, right? Not to some economists. Now, I'm going to add here, not to economists that understand economics. And it talks about how last week, Miami to Phoenix, people leaving, this was during Harvey. So during Harvey or Irma, when the hurricane was bearing down on Florida, prices from Miami to Phoenix airfare jumped from $547 to $3,200. That's huge, right? Now, why did they jump? You and I both understand, because we understand how economics works, that when there's a higher demand for something, the prices go up. But this is just airfare. Now I'm talking about food, bottled water, that type of thing. And that's where this anti-gouging thing, I think, gets even more complicated. How do stores work? You guys understand this? A store, let's say you have Well, this is in the South, so, you know, I don't think they have Albertsons. They have Piggly Wigglies. Do they still have those? So if you've got your friendly neighborhood Piggly Wiggly store, no, it's a real chain, if you don't know this. Yeah. Anyway, so the Piggly Wiggly, what do they have on their store shelves and maybe a little bit in the back stock room? They maintain enough goods for regular demand in that given area. And they have made a science of it, right? They have created a science of figuring out economically, because, you know, what does a store like that not want to do? They don't want the food to spoil. They don't want too much goods on hand. Most of the stuff in a grocery store goes bad. So I'll explain. Now, where am I going with this, right? Why is this important? You've got to understand how the world around you works. Tell your kids, explain this to them. They're not going to learn this in school. When I come back, I'll explain how this works. And I'll explain why you will see in the newspaper in the coming days or online, wherever you get your news, you're going to see pictures of bare shelves. And invariably, under those headlines, you're going to hear all sorts of sob stories, how the federal government needs to come in and help. And I'm going to tell you, I'm going to explain here step by step why that is absolute BS. Okay? Don't go anywhere. Sam Rojofsky back right after this.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
Hurricane Florence making landfall. That means empty store shelves all across the affected areas. We've seen the photos. Why are these store shelves empty? Is this scenes from Bolshevik Russia, from the USSR circa 1983? Well, kinda. Let me explain. As I was saying right before the break, if you are going to your neighborhood grocery store in California, it doesn't matter where it is, that store maintains goods on the shelf only to the extent that they believe that they can sell those goods in a reasonable amount of time so that they're not dealing with spoilage. Stores lose money when they don't sell goods, and things like anything from bread to bananas all go bad over a period of time. We understand how that works. Now, in order to maintain that perfect level of stock, the store does not maintain enough supply to satiate demand when everyone descends on the store and suddenly buys groceries for 3 weeks instead of for 3 days. Most Americans, on average, shop for about 5 days' worth of groceries. This means that when you increase demand, let's just say, we'll round up and say it's seven. Now people are going and getting 3 weeks of supplies of food, 3 weeks of supplies of water or more. Can a store like that possibly sustain demand for three times its normal expected level? Well, the answer is no. And these Pollyannas, these fantasy land people that we call Democrats, liberals and the like, think that stores are supposed to suddenly move stock into affected areas. But do you know why they don't? They don't because of these anti-gouging laws. For example, in North Carolina, the law has been for years, it's basically you can't increase prices about 5%. Do you know what it costs a store to take, from 200, 300, 500, 800 miles away to bring in suddenly three times the amount of goods? To increase freezer storage for three times the amount of ice. To increase refrigeration for three times the amount of milk. To increase store shelves, to bring in temporary shelving to hold the stuff three times. It costs money. I know the federal, I understand, I get it. Democrats do not understand how economics work. But to offer the goods for sale isn't like, you know, click a button and move it around. It's not, you know, we're not playing with Barbie here. This is real. It costs money to transport it. It costs money to preserve it. And there's a risk associated of moving it into a disaster area, paying people, their workers, to remain in place, hiring extra workers, bringing workers from outside the disaster area. What, you're going to do all that for an extra 5%? But you would do it. Piggly Wiggly, Best Buy, Albertsons, any company that, I don't know, wants to make a profit would do it if they could charge any price they want. Now, what is that? Is that greed? Sure. And maybe this is, you know, truism of Gordon Gekko that greed is good, in that greed produces an incentive, an inducement, right, to bring, to create a mass movement of resources to a disaster area. That's what you want. That's what, if I was in, you know, if earthquake hit Orange County here, and suddenly the Republic of Irvine was sealed off from the world, and there's people coming along my store that I can walk to, be a long walk, but I can walk to it. Suddenly, I have an option of no food or food that costs 10 times the amount. I'm not going to buy a lot of food, right? That's one effect of this. I'm not going to go in. I'm not going to hoard food that I don't need, but I'm going to buy just enough food that I will need for my family, because 10 times the food or death, I don't know. Most of us would choose to pay the money. This is a classic case of allocating resources based on need relative to supply. This is how economics work normally. And it is also it's one of many, many, many examples where the government, trying to do something good, trying to help, only screws everybody, right? Ronald Reagan said it best. Hi, we're here from the federal government. We're here to help. And those are the scariest words you could ever hear. We're going to step away from this briefly here. Too much hurricane talk. We're going to have let's just continue with this topic. We won't do a legal segment today. This is so timely. I want to stay on track here and track this the story. There's a great example of this, by the way, from back Hurricane Fran. This was back in 1996. Ironically, of all places, in North Carolina, there's four guys that exactly did this type of thing. I'm going to go through their story. You tell me if the law's a good idea. I'll hear from you. Okay, don't go anywhere. Sam Rzhovsky back right after this.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam Rzhovsky. You'll find him very anything. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
If a flag flying bravely over the Atlantic Ocean is no longer appearing on a webcam, is it still there? It's an existential question facing man in our time. Yeah, was Kaepernick still kneeling? Is that the... Well, does he kneel off camera? Is that what you're getting at? All right, Sam Rzhovsky, Sam Nation, here on the Sam Nation Radio Network. Happy Friday, friends. The king of common sense sitting here behind the microphone, ready to deal out some reason and drop some truth bombs. So prepare yourself. Democrats, find a bunker and get out of the way. Hurricane Florence has hit the North Carolina coast, has made landfall, and they're getting a lot of rain. We're expecting about 4 feet of rain, which I think is, you know, again, speaking of allocating your supply and demand, that's not for, they're going to have too much water. And when was the last time a single drop of precipitation landed anywhere near Southern California? It's a cruel world out there, folks. It's a cruel world. So anyway, price gouging. How does this work? Explaining why, if you limit the marketplace, if you say you cannot charge in a time of exigent circumstances any more than an X small percent increase, you remove the incentive for the person that is going to take tremendous risk to bring that good into a disaster-stricken area. You know, during Katrina, my brother-in-law was working for T-Mobile, and he led a crew that went around fixing towers. Boy, his stories are harrowing. It's like a war zone. I don't think this is something we don't realize as California. It was a war zone. Now, why was he there? Why was T-Mobile paying him incredible gobs of money, right? He wouldn't have gone in there for his regular paycheck. Are you crazy? You think that... No, I know. Ben's a good guy. But do you think... Probably listening to this, too, so I got to be careful. Ben, you're a great guy. You would have done it for free. I know that. But me, if I was in your shoes, hell's bells, I wouldn't go in there for just, you know, my regular, you know, time and a half overtime. Screw that. T-Mobile had to pay people extra to motivate them to go in. Now, T-Mobile's motivation as a company is greed-based, too. Sooner they get up, customer loyalty. A big region like that getting cell service down, the last company to restore service is going to lose all its subscribers within 3 months. That's what's going to happen. So this is how these companies think. They got to get their people in there, get those towers fixed, get them up, get everything working. Because they need to maintain their customers. So these four guys I was telling you about, North Carolina, back in 1996, they see the hurricane coming, Hurricane Fran. And they live about 2 hours away from where it hit. It hit the Raleigh-Durham area, Chapel Hills, the Tri-City area there in North Carolina. Hit it hard. Trees on the roads. Emergency vehicles can't get by. It's terrible. Horrible. And by the way, it's 97 degrees outside and everyone's underwater. What is a commodity in those circumstances that people need, right? They have no power, right? They're underwater, no power, and it's 97 degrees. And whatever food that they have on hand is rapidly spoiling because the refrigerators are not cold anymore. Well, they need ice. And about an hour and a half away, ice is selling for, are you ready? About $1 a bag. In the disaster area, there is no ice. No ice. No ice for you. What's the solution? Well, these four guys decided, let's buy a bunch of ice, rent two small freezer trucks, buy a bunch of ice, bring it in, and sell it at a profit. What you have there, by the way, is capitalism. What you have there is the market economy responding to a need and being flexible enough to provide a service in a way that not even the government can do. Now, I am going to go a little long in this segment because I want to finish the thought. So these guys go in. They buy about 500 bags of ice. Sorry, I have it here. $1.70 a bag is what it costs. So that's quite an outlay of cash. They don't even have a guarantee, incidentally, that they're going to get there. They bring chainsaws. They have to go out and they actually end up buying chainsaws. Why? Because there's trees all over the road. So these guys, and they look like burly guys. These guys come out. They're chainsawing trees, moving them out of the road. Incidentally, clearing roads that later are used by emergency vehicles. This comes out in later testimony because I don't want to give anything away here. But these guys end up selling ice about 10 bucks a bag. Everybody lines up. People buy ice. And then the popos show up. To those of you born before 1970, that means the police. What do the police do? Well, you guys are violating the anti-gouging law. We're going to arrest you. They arrest them. They confiscate all the ice, even from people that bought it. Confiscate, impound the truck, send them over to impound, turn them off. The ice melts. Nobody has any ice. But as this is going down, this is how dumb we are as a country, right? These are the voters, right? These are a bunch of Democrats out there going, yeah, show them. Yeah, this is like Venezuelans excited that the refineries are being nationalized and stolen by the state. Now they're eating their pets. The expression is hoist by their own petards. So anyway, there it is. There is a story. Now, at the end of the day, what do we know? We know we have a bunch of people who wanted ICE and didn't get it, not because of the marketplace not doing what it needed to do, but because of the state. And the state has this law just to make all of us, quote unquote, useful idiots that come around every few years and vote, happy.
Yeah, greed is bad. You show those guys, you put them in jail.
This really ought to make you mad. And it ought to make you mad because your government is working against you in an emergency. Now, there are two articles that came out right around this week that all of this transpired back in 1996 and Raleigh-Durham. And these articles illustrate this point to a T. Don't go anywhere. Sam Rachofsky, Sam Nation on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
Sam Rachofsky, Sam Nation. All right. The Raleigh-Durham police came in. The popos arrived at the scene of the illegal ice market, arrested the perps, confiscated the ice, promptly melted it. So no one in Raleigh-Durham had any ice. And the intrepid reporters over at the Raleigh newspaper called the News and Observer wrote these two articles. First, on September 10th, about a week after the storm, here's a page one story. This is written by a guy named Isley. Quote, ice shortages are becoming severe in some places, so much so that local counties are asking the federal government to send as much ice as it can. Well, hold up. So you arrested four Kokomo Jokomos that went in, took the risk, bought the ice, provided the ice, sent it in, cleared the roads for you guys with their own chainsaws, their own trucks, did everything. You didn't require the government. All the government had to do was get out of their way. You arrested those guys, took their ice and melted it. What did that cost me as a taxpayer in California? Bupkis nothing for those guys to come in and bring the ice. What is it going to cost me now, Mr. Isley, at the Raleigh News and Observer, what is it going to cost me as a taxpayer in California to now have the federal government come in and provide ice? Well, first of all, here's the thing. Here's a lot, A. B, my guess is, and I know the federal government like I know the back of my hand, my guess is that the unit cost, the price gouging cost, and let's say, what was it? These guys were charging 10 a bag. Bought it for $170, so we're going to call it $8, the $8 per bag surcharge for all that risk. How much do you think, knowing the federal government, each bag of ice is going to cost $300? That's how, by the time you pay all the fat bureaucrats, useless, absolute useless ninnies, sitting at their computers playing solitaire, by the pay you give them all their paychecks, 70% of the ice is going to melt because some dummy is not going to, you know, plug in the refrigerator. By the time the federal government is done delivering the ice, it's going to be $300 a bag, and it's going to get there 3 weeks later when nobody needs it or they don't need it as badly. The next article that comes out is just about as bothersome. Right now, They're talking about Florida Governor Lawton Chiles and South Carolina Governor David Beasley. They're having a meeting among their various important people that run their public safety divisions. Quote, at the cabinet meeting, Richard Moore, Hunt's Secretary for Crime Control and Public Safety, said he was deploying the state alcohol law enforcement officers to investigate reports of price gouging of products in short supply. Now, first of all, you see the irony, right? On one hand, they're like, we don't have a good that we need. So we're going to ask, oh, please, federal government, come save us and deliver this good. And at the same time, the state is working to punish people who want to bring in that good and are just wanting to charge a lot of money for it. And I have a novel concept for you. And I know Democrats who force us to buy health insurance don't understand this. But if somebody comes along and is charging $10 for a bag of ice that costs $170, you're not obligated to buy it. You don't have to buy the bag of ice. You can choose not to. And actually, that is the, going back, this is so important. That is actually why the example I gave earlier here about the plane tickets during the storms that were bad coming down on Florida. We saw those Miami to Phoenix tickets, people getting out of Miami was a direct hit at that in that time. So the tickets went up from $500 to over $3,000. Was that bad? Is it good? Well, obviously, two things happen if you require the airlines to maintain the price at $500. One, they're going to sell out in a second, and that's just going to be that. You're not going to have the airline will have no motivation to add extra flights to accommodate demand. They're not going to change their whole grid because, you know, airplanes, trust me, airlines use their airplanes at all times. So they're not going to move airplanes around from markets that are at $500 where they're making a regular profit to an area where they could be making a bigger profit, but can't now. So inventory isn't going to change. But the other part, and this is a very important too, is people on the ground are not going to be making the same cost-benefit analysis if the ticket is $500 than if it's $3,200. What do I mean? It means that the guy that is in the eye of the storm is the guy that, one, is most likely to buy that ticket. The guy that might be inconvenienced, that's 100 miles away, but doesn't want to deal with maybe a power outage or whatnot, he's more likely to stay if the ticket's $3,200. Does that make sense? The guy who's going to be directly hit, he's the guy that wants to get out. If you maintain the cost at $500 for both guys are racing. The guy that is, I'll pay $500, no problem. It's not a lot of money. $3,200? What? I'm not paying that. No way. Hell's bells. I'll just stay here. I'm fine. I got a generator. I'll wait out the 4 days without power. But it's taken an opportunity away from the guy who's in the eye of the storm. It creates a danger, in fact. And these are the unintended consequences of the government trying to help us. God forbid. I wish the government would stop trying to help us. It's scary. You heard of the Waffle House Index? FEMA, the federal government, and the Waffle House Index. That up next. Don't go anywhere. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation here on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, on the show tonight is Sam Rogowski. Now, what Sam is the leading word in correct thinking, as opposed to Ed, which is drunk thinking. And that's usually where the left ends up, on the wrong side of right.
Hi, I got a question for you. How do you think FEMA, Federal Emergency Management group there. Why, how do you think that they figure out how a particular area is doing and how hard it's been struck by a storm? Well, God, don't we have satellites? We have satellites. We've got the billion-dollar machines whizzing through space, right? Taking photographs, video even, in real time. What else do we have? We got meteorological stations set up to measure how much rainfall is in an area. We can see, I think, to some extent, all power utilities can see where power is up and down, and it can be represented on some kind of a fancy screen. But I mean, there are so many different indicators. So guess what FEMA uses in the South to determine how hard your neighborhood has been hit in a hurricane? The Waffle House. Now, if you're from Southern California, think In-N-Out, franchised, dirtier, open 24/7, iconic still, right? Iconic. Fried chicken, waffles, you get the idea. 24/7, though. These places are open all night long. And they're, I understand, they're pretty tolerant to drunks. So when the bar closes, the Waffle House is where people go to eat some fried chicken, have a waffle, and sober up before the ride home. Well, Robbie, when you were stationed in the South, well, did you spend your fair share of time there? Anthony Bourdain said that the food was better than the French Laundry. Do you say that about In-N-Out, too? Well, rest in peace. So here we have it. The Waffle House Index is a real thing. What is this? Well, apparently FEMA figured out, this is all the way back in the early 2000s, during the 2004 hurricane season, that they figured out that the Waffle Houses were an effective measure of how a particular area was hit in a hurricane. And they created a scale. Now, because it's the feds and they keep things very simple for their simple minds, it's color-coded, red, yellow, and green. Three color-coded levels. What do you think green means? Green means that everything is fine at the Waffle House. They're serving their regular menu. All things are on their menu, and they're open, uninterrupted. Now, yellow now, is if the restaurant serves a limited menu. And this tells them that the area has lost power or they're running low on supplies. Both of them would indicate some level of affectation, right? Now, if it's red, what is it? Red means that the Waffle House is down. It's closed. That means that the area has been hit hard. Once again, you have the federal government relying on indicators from the private sector, knowing full well that the private sector is the best measure of how an area is doing. And this is partly due to the chain being so dedicated to being open all the time. So if their commitment to serving their full menu at all hours of the day is in any way impacted, it's, of course, a measure of how hard a storm has hit. FEMA said in a 2011 blog post, quote, "The Waffle House test doesn't just tell us how quickly a business might rebound. It also tells us how the larger community is faring." So, quote, "The sooner restaurants, grocery stores, and corner stores, banks can reopen, the sooner local economies will start generating revenue again, signaling a strong recovery for the area." Well, I just want you all to know that the Waffle House Storm Center is activated and monitoring Florence. Plan ahead and be safe, FEMA tweeted yesterday. Can you believe all this stuff? All right, let's get into some of the things that are going on in the news, plus some political reactions to Trump's expected reactions to the storm, to Hurricane Florence. This up next, you do not want to miss Jeffrey Toobin on CNN and the outrageous things he said about Trump. I foreshadowed a little bit of this at the beginning of this hour regarding Puerto Rico. Sam Rogowski, Sam Nation, back right after this.
We shall fight on the airwaves.
We shall fight on Twitter and Facebook. We shall broadcast our program, whatever the cost may be. And if Sam Nation lasts for 1,000 years, men will say this was their finest hour.
Sam Rzhovsky, Sam Nation, second hour of podcast wonderfulness. Here we go. Let's get right to it. Hurricane Maria that hit Puerto Rico in 2017 quickly became the Democrats' effort to make that storm Trump's Katrina. Now, what do I mean by this? Well, of course, you know, Bush was responsible for Katrina. Everybody knows that. I watched CNN. it didn't help the photo op of him flying on Air Force One at 2,000 feet over the, people suffer. It didn't help. But the part of the story of Katrina that was always buried was you had all these Democrats in the South that ran the city into the ground, ran the county in the ground, ran the state in the ground, and they were all the ones responsible. They knew that they lived in, that they, had levees that were crumbling, infrastructure that was poor. They knew that they had a city that was a significant portion of it below seawater. What happens in a hurricane? I don't want to give anything away, but you have an increase in water level. So even if you have structures that are, 10 feet above sea level, there can still be a storm surge that affects them. Anyway, I digress. So Hurricane Maria, this week, what have we heard? The media is pounding the story that Trump killed 3,000 Puerto Ricans, practically single-handedly, in his failure to help them in Hurricane Maria, after Hurricane Maria. This was last year. Trump, of course, what did Trump do? It is a falsehood and a lie, okay? He's getting pounded in the media. He is out of touch. He doesn't get it. He's out to lunch. On The View on Wednesday, Abby Huntsman tried to defend Trump. This is the exchange between her and Sonny Hostin.
A lot of these deaths took place after that storm because of the lack of resources.
Yeah, I think it's humiliating. Yeah. It's embarrassing for our country. And I don't think this president cares. Something like over 90% of the additional deaths that happened after the hurricane struck were preventable.
Yeah.
So we're talking about the fact that this government allowed its own citizens to die. I thought that's what we only saw in dictatorships.
Oh, okay. Do you remember seeing the photos about 2 weeks ago of the million plus bottles of water that were miraculously found laying rotting in a field in Puerto Rico? The government sent water and the idiots, the local government on the ground, couldn't even pass it up. And by the way, I've always suspected that this was intentional, largely. What do I mean by that? You remember that crazy mayor down there in San Juan? I mean, she was running a full-scale campaign against Trump from the get-go before the storm even hit. For her narrative and the Democratic Party narrative to work, FEMA's response had to not be good enough, right? So if they got supplies, which they did, and time and time again in the months afterward, we heard about supplies that got there and didn't get passed out. We heard about people who didn't have power for months. Is this the federal government's fault? Is this Trump's fault? Is this because he doesn't like brown people? Well, according to Jeffrey Toobin, yes, quite simply, indeed.
Isn't the story that these people who died, apparently thousands of them in Puerto Rico, 3,000, as you point out, they're not white people. And they don't count to Donald Trump as much as the deaths of white people. I mean, you hate to say that about someone, but look at his record. Isn't that indicative of who he is and what he stands for?
I don't know, Jeffrey. I don't know if I can draw that conclusion, but we certainly know that they didn't have the apparatus in place when they knew that hurricane was coming to Maria, and you have to ask why.
This is so profoundly disgusting. It just, I mean, if it even if you don't like Trump, you've really got to go to a dark and far extreme to believe that FEMA didn't respond to Puerto Rico because the people down there have a different skin tone. I don't know that Toobin actually believes this. I know a lot of Democrats do. I don't think Toobin himself does. And that makes this so irresponsible. I think it ties into some of the other stories, the increasing levels of violence against Trump supporters and language against the president. And what do I hear? You know, when I complain about this to my friends, and I'm, you know, talking amongst people not necessarily of my same political idea, they go, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, Sam, what do you mean the rising vitriol from the left? Trump started this." And I think to myself, wait, what did he start? Did he start? He started this by calling Hillary Crooked Hillary. He started this by making fun of little Marco Rubio. Wait, he started this by calling Jeb Bush low energy Jeb. He started this. The hurricane story right now fits exactly into this entire deteriorating, maddening descent that the left is engaged in, where they think that they are fighting fire with fire. They think that their rhetoric is an answer to the horrible, terrible things that Trump has started. He opened Pandora's box, and this is just our reply. But I think, I'm just telling you, this does not wear well. Toobin, you know who Toobin is, by the way? He's like their CNN Supreme Court expert. He's a constitutional law attorney. I don't know if he teaches a class, if he's a professor, but he studied under Alan Dershowitz, by the way, at Harvard. So he goes to Harvard. I know not everybody that graduates from Harvard, you know, has got a brain, but presumably this guy's not an idiot. And also, he has always traditionally tried to keep himself on the rails of some sort of, you know, middle of the road commentary. For Toobin, hear me out, for Toobin to go this out there, yeah, Trump basically was committing genocide. I mean, that's what he's saying. It's the definition of genocide. Is so outlandish and outrageous. Why does he think he can say this? Why do you think they can make this? They are so emboldened, one, because they think that the Trump presidency is about to end at any given moment. But they also believe that this is the appropriate answer to Trump being a mischievous schoolboy during the debates and during the campaign and wiping the floor with them. And they think that this is an appropriate answer. And it's not. Trump, the most brilliant thing Trump has ever done is bait these people into saying ridiculous, disgusting things like this. There hasn't been any politician in my life who has done more on our side to erode the credibility of the left than Donald Trump. The New York Times, we're talking about these Puerto Rico deaths, this hurricane deaths back in Hurricane Maria. The New York Times, they took the death through October at 1,000, 1,052 to be exact. That's from their own story. Official death toll in Puerto Rico, 64. Actual deaths may be 1,052. And this was updated December 2017, which would have been, what, 3 months after the storm? 4 months? 2 months? 3 months. It was September. Think about that. I'm not going on Snopes. The New York Times that hates Trump, right? They're not going to give Trump cut him any slack. I mean, they're trying to official death toll as of December 9th at 10:43 a.m. Eastern time was 64. And you're telling me that grew to 3,000? BS. It's just not true. Again, I'm not going to the New York Times and NLB. I'm saying if it really were 10 deaths higher, they would absolutely put it at 10 deaths. They're taking 64 deaths, exaggerating it to 1,000, and now we're at 3,000, and Trump's calling BS, and everybody's going, what a heartless guy. But I'm telling you, the truth and the truthfulness of the record matters. And in the end, all of this is going to come back to bite these people. Who trusts journalists who report this way? Who trusts Tubin? Now, having said, what was this? Isn't the story that these people who died, apparently thousands of them in Puerto Rico, 3,000, as you point out, they're not white people. They don't count to Donald Trump as much as the deaths of white people. I mean, wow, you really hate to say this about someone, but look at his record. That's what he stands for. It's insanity. It's absolute craziness. I think, well, look, this does more in the long run to shake the confidence in a system that already was broken. He's debating these people. This is Trump derangement syndrome in its most classic and purest sense. Because he's getting these people to just to go to go full crazy. Well, what's that? Well, do you think it's hurting Trump? You think it's going to hurt Trump, but it's going to hurt the media more. Well, yes and no. It depends on, again, it depends on how it shakes out, right? It depends if the story becomes a month later, you know, Trump was maybe right about this. You have the same thing going into this as you had during the election when everybody told us that Trump was going to. What was the story? The prevailing story after Trump was elected was, you know what? Trump didn't even want to be president. He wasn't going to govern. He can't govern. He can't govern. He's not going to. He's going to just turn it over to Pence. Remember those news stories? Well, can we take any of those journalists seriously anymore? It's a joke. I do think that the effect of a lot of this, I think this helps him. I think this is a net positive for Trump in the long run. What the only precarious thing I see right now with what's going on inside the White House is you've got all these leaks, and these leaks are creating a tremendous amount of pressure on Trump to maintain privacy, right? To maintain secrecy. Secrecy is important to the operation of any enterprise, not the least of which a White House. Well, we know this. I mean, every administration has taken great steps to maintain privacy of its information. So Trump right now, all these stories are coming out, and I believe most of what's in these Woodward books and certainly what was in Fire and Fury and all, there's a lot of it that's exaggerated. But it has the effect of making Trump paranoid. More paranoid than he already is. It's a guy who only drinks Diet Coke because he wants to actually see the can open up. He has fear of being poisoned. This was well before he was president. He eats McDonald's because the food's already ready. He knows the food can't be tampered with. So he's a paranoid guy, and this is making him more paranoid and making him more distrustful. And it's making him less inclined to rely on the infrastructure that he needs, the human infrastructure that he needs. Nobody wants to be served by a den of traitors. But on the other hand, becoming increasingly isolated and paranoid may have exactly the effect that the media wants. And I think that is really the greatest threat in all of this that Trump faces, where, you know, at this point, a lot of what's written about him is, in fact, it's art. But we just don't want life to imitate art, right? We don't want for the stories to come out that Trump is delusional, paranoid, da-da-da-da-da, and in the net effect of it, making him more so. And I think in that sense, there's got to be some sort of reset there. And I do think that these are precarious times. All right, let's take a break. Sam Rachofsky, Sam Nation, here on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
In this present crisis, government is the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And Sam Nation is the solution. Of course, you need jelly beans for that.
Samerjowski, Sam Nation, a great illustration of the, we'll call it loosening of standards of decency and decorum. And that's putting this mildly, would be this exchange. There's an actress, a former Broadway star, Carol Cook, talking to a TMZ reporter along with her husband. Then there's also a bystander that you can hear in the clip, male bystander. By the way, this gal, Carol Cook, she looks like a, I don't know, if they made a wax replica of her in for Madame Tussauds, it would be hard to tell the two apart. A lot of war paint, friends, a lot of war paint. All right, here's the exchange.
What did you think about this story that someone brought the Trump banner to the Frozen on Broadway? Did you see that?
The Trump banner. I didn't.
Now, is that a proper venue for, a Trumper to bring a
well,
banner
my
to?
Well, my answer to that is...
Oh, this is good. Where was... No, you should... No.
Where is John Wilkes Booth when you need him?
Oh.
Right? Where is he when you need him?
So we need to kill President Trump?
What? He did. No. What?
Why not? Should.
This is good, says Cook's husband. Where was... No, honey, you should say it. So then she says, Carol Cook says, where is John Wilkes Booth when you need him, right? Where is he when you need him? Bystander says, wait, so we need to kill President Trump? Cook's husband says, why not? And Cook says, well, someone should. Look, if somebody said that about Obama, all hell would break loose. Now, this is a news story, and it's being treated almost a little tongue-in-cheek and funny, and everybody's giggling about it. Because the left has normalized violence against Trump and violence against Trump's supporters. Normalized it. It's allowed. And you know why? Because Trump is so despicable that he killed 3,000 Puerto Ricans because they're brown. How can anybody support him? Any decent person would want him eliminated. You know, the left always talks about how, you know, the terrible things, you know, that Hitler first, what did he do? He dehumanized the enemy. It's true. Through the Nuremberg laws, he dehumanized Jews, made them less than human, less than full citizens, gradually stripped them of their rights through codified law. And gradually that resulted in a place where society was, well, it was, it didn't just suddenly go straight to, you know, mass murder. There was a process in place. And they bring this up all the time. This is what Trump is doing. This is what Trump is doing. And the irony of it, this is a pot calling the kettle black. Is that a racist thing? I don't know. But I'm just saying, they're the ones doing it. First, Trump is Hitler. Trump kills Puerto Ricans. 3,000 of them. What, 63 official deaths? Oh, I don't know. That's not enough. So, and then it's absolutely, I mean, who wouldn't want a little John Wilkes Booth action on President Trump at the theater if he's killing so many brown people because of the color of their skin? And if you missed last segment, or this is coming out of the blue, this is a reference to Jeffrey Toobin, not anything I said. This is so sad. Full-scale Trump derangement syndrome, in effect. And it's wrong, it's disgusting, and in the end, the left will pay for this. This is going to cost them. Trust me. All right, Friday Funny. We got to lighten the mood. Up next, don't go anywhere. Sam Rajofsky here on the Sam Nation Radio Network.
I was listening the other day to a friend of mine. His name is Sam, Sam Majowski. You'll find him very entertaining. He's very stylish. He's always wearing his suit. And if you want to hear someone's opinion that absolutely is correct, you listen to Sam. Anyone else is a waste of time.
the Florida of the West, Arizona, Gilbert, the city of Gilbert, guy gets arrested for something that I don't think happens very often. Wait, you think is it unfair to call Arizona the Florida of the West? It's got retirees, you know, people there to have, you know, a little bit of the sun, less expensive housing. But you also get a lot of weird stories in Arizona, don't you? It's not as weird as Florida. Okay, I give you that. So at any rate, there's a 31-year-old school crossing guard in Gilbert, Arizona. He's actually employed by the Unified School District there, the public school district, and he's a crossing guard. Now, as part of his job, he gets fingerprinted. They do a full background check, comes out absolutely clean. As a parent, you got to remind yourself that just because somebody has never been caught doing pervy things does not mean that they haven't done those things. They just haven't been caught yet. So he comes back clean, but it is revealed this week that Paul Anthony Menchaca has been posing as a Down syndrome man and having certified nurses and caregivers give him baths, change his diapers, and otherwise care for him, all for his personal, we'll say, gratification. I have a lot of questions. How do you set this up, right? I mean, you're going to pose as a Down syndrome individual that can't even bathe, right? You use a diaper. That's how bad your condition is. How are you setting this up, right? How are you contacting nurses? I went through a website called care.com that apparently provides caregivers for this type of thing. So how do you do it? So I guess the way he did it is he posed online as a mother or an aunt or something. He posed as a functioning adult. Amy, that was the pseudonym. And then, you know, recruited these women, but they never met Amy. I guess he must have. It's not clear exactly. I tried to look this up, but the whole scheme came to light when one of the caregivers began to get suspicious about it. Something was off, right? These are professionals. These are people that, you know, presumably know what a Down sufferer, you know, what type of disability. So they had some idea that something was up. And I guess he had one caregiver pick him up and drop him off and that type of thing. Like, he would go to the women's houses, which, I mean, I don't know. It seems like an odd thing to do. But at any rate, she follows him to his house. Surprise, surprise, where is he living? With his parents. I don't think that's a plot twist. But anyway, so she knocks on the door, talks to his parents. Parents are like, hell, what are you talking about? You know, he's totally fine. No, he's not. Paul has a problem, mom and dad. And he's going to get some jail time, I think, to figure it out. He was charged with, fraudulent schemes and sexual abuse. My guess is he's not going to be a school crossing guard after all of this. Now, there's one more story here. Speaking of high functioning. No, I can't. I just... Snails. Where's the story? Oh, yes. Congham, England. This is as far away from Florida or Arizona as you could possibly get. There's a race, an international snail race championship. More than 150 snails took part in the annual event, held at a summer fete in Norfolk, Eastern England, on Saturday, where a silver tankard stuffed with lettuce leaves was the prize. So here's how this works. Are you interested in this at all? Is this snail? What do you think, Dr. Audio? Is this okay? The snails are placed on a special damp cloth marked with three concentric circles. And the creatures race. Now, here's the distance, right? Here's why this probably doesn't make it on TV. The creatures race 13 inches to the outer ring. Quote, "We take this seriously," snail racer John McLean told Reuters. "We have got training slopes. We look at diet. We are drug compliant as well. It's the whole thing when you look at elite sports." The competition has been held since the 1960s, with each race lasting several minutes. Can you imagine watching some elite snails slithering 13 inches across a damp cloth? Oh, my goodness. Joe Waterfield from the nearby village of Grimston found the eventual winner among her plants. I pulled him out this morning and told him if he didn't win, I would squash him. Sam Rajofsky on the Sam Nation Radio Network. Back after this.
You're looking for a show that doesn't sugarcoat the truth. Sam Nation will accommodate you.
Sam Rajofsky, Sam Nation. Here, one thing to add to the snail race is, am I going to admit this? Yeah, I am. I once had a pet snail. Do you know this? Robbie, Robbie's shaking his head. Well, I was on my way to the fifth grade. This would have been in 1991. I was on my way to class, and I walked to school. Uphill both ways, right? And I saw across the path was a really beautiful garden snail. Nothing special, but he was good looking. I mean, he had a nice shell, good color, looked healthy. And I apparently was a lonely kid, and we did not have a pet at home. So I dumped out my lunch into my backpack and took my my brown bag, right, paper bag, and put the snail in the bag, and I kept him there all day. He was in my desk. You know, we had those desks that had, I don't know, kind of U-shaped underneath, and you could store stuff. So I hid him deep behind the back of my bag, and I came home that day and got one of those giant glass used peanut butter jars and put him in it with some lettuce, and I named him Boobiek. I don't know where that name came from, but that was his name. And so I had this snail as a pet, and I have to hand it to my parents that they encouraged this, or at least didn't discourage it. I guess they thought this is a hell of a lot easier than a dog, and it of course was. But I would walk him in the evenings, and I'd spray down the patio, and I'd put him down on the pavement, and he'd walk around, and then I'd have to wash out his jar every day. And give him fresh lettuce. And at night, it was really funny. You could actually hear a snail eating lettuce. It's loud enough. In my bedroom, I remember I could hear him just biting the lettuce at night. So yeah, that's a little glimpse into my childhood. But no, I never... What are you guys laughing at? This is rude. I get nothing but abuse here. Well, Yeah, diaries of a Trump supporter, you know. Well, we don't like Puerto Ricans, you know, but we do have pet snails. No, this is nonsense, right? Okay. Hey, there was another story. There was another story this week about violence against Trump supporters, and it was here in California in Hayward. There was a California congressional candidate attacked with a knife. At some kind of a county fair in Northern California for his apparent support of President Donald Trump, according to the Alameda County Sheriff's Department. Republican Rudy Peters, who's challenging a Democrat Representative Eric Swalwell for the 15th District, was working in a booth where a guy, 35 years old, threatened him and then attacked him. Here is Rudy Peters talking about what happened at the Castro Valley Fall Festival.
He picks up the coffee cup to rear back to throw it at us, and I jump around the table. He throws a coffee cup, it misses us, it hits the ground and breaks. So I come out and grab him, and wrestle him and throw him down to the ground. He's screaming, "I'll kill you, MF, or I'll kill you, I'll kill you." And he's kind of circling me, trying to get the knife out. He would have stabbed me. I mean, he had it out saying, "I'm going to kill you, MF, or I'm going to kill you." And he was, I could see his thumb trying to get the knife out. So I've asked my supporters and followers in open events, I don't want them around me. I don't want their safety in jeopardy.
Yeah. See, now this story is interesting, especially for what did not happen afterwards. What didn't happen are conversations about how political dialogue, vitriol, words, whether written or spoken, motivated this man to act violently against another human being. Now, whenever there is a Trump supporter or a right winger, especially these horrible, like these racists down in the South that had their, you know, white power rallies, that's Trump. That's Trump. But when you have Antifa out there and they've been doing this now for 2 years, beating up Trump supporters, well, that's just, you know, that's just people acting violently and it's isolated. It's just relative to that one person, a bad choice that they're making. Matter of fact, when it's Antifa, if you get people on the left actually defending it. You know, we're a country that values certain equities, right? We value a certain golden rule, you know, it may be a religious thing, but no, we believe in fair play. As an attorney, I see this all the time in court. Juries actually, at the end of the day, in civil cases, right, they don't get tied up in the law and what people are entitled to get under the law. They care about equitable resolutions. And juries, by the way, guys, this is interesting, is that jury is a great cross-section of society, right? These are people that are registered to vote. They show up. They do their civic duty. So to me, juries are always very a great indicator of what the kind of America is doing, certainly in an area like here in Orange County or L.A. or wherever. And juries really do care about right and wrong. They care about fairness, and they make decisions based on that. And I think voters do, too. And what the left risks here is just pushing the envelope too far. This Brett Kavanaugh thing is a great example of it. You heard the latest on this? Senator Feinstein, fighting for her political life, drops a bomb on the Kavanaugh proceedings. I'll tell you about that right when we come back. Just a little snippet here of some craziness. Sam Rzhovsky, back right after this.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, on the show tonight is Sam Rzhovsky. Now, what Sam is the leading word in correct thinking, as opposed to Ed, which is drunk thinking. And that's usually where the left ends up, on the wrong side of right.
With the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh now firmly in the rearview mirror, weeks and weeks and weeks have gone by since President Trump made his announcement. There have been untold hours, thousands upon thousands pages of documents and records sifted through, hours and hours of investigative work done, right? Testimony now for a week. Ask him anything, right? Anything goes. Only now Senator Dianne Feinstein comes out with a silent, right? She doesn't want to come forward. This woman does not want her name in the media. So an anonymous allegation of sexual misconduct against Brett Kavanaugh. That was the first headline I heard. Now, the left-wing newspaper The Guardian reports this from a source who is familiar with the contents of the letter. Quote, a source who said they were briefed on the contents of the letter said it described an incident involving Kavanaugh and a woman that took place when they were both, how old? Do you know how old? 17 and in high school. Now, according to the source, Kavanaugh and a male friend had locked this woman in a room against her will. making her feel threatened. But she was apparently able to get out of the room. Wait, how is that sexual? I mean, how is it sex harassment? How is that? It's a, they're in high school. I found out here later, it's a party. There's nothing, what? It's a prank. Now, Feinstein says, I have handed this over to the FBI. The FBI today came out and said, yeah, we're not interested. This is the kind of nonsense that happens. So Kavanaugh is going to get a minimum of 54 or 55 votes. He's going to be the next Supreme Court justice, and the Democrats are all going to look stupid. End of story. All right. I don't know. It's been a, well, my heart goes out to everybody in North Carolina and those affected by Florence. This really, really stinks. Would you want to, I don't know. Would you want to live in the South where, you know, you don't have earthquakes? I guess the one good thing about earthquakes is you don't drown in the aftermath, but you do run out of water and you have gas line explosions. But you don't know that an earthquake is coming. At least with a storm, you know that it's coming. And I want to make sure that that webcam comes back up on the frying pan tower. And no, I'm not referring to Missy Daniels' legal defense fund. Okay. Sam Rejofsky, Sam Nation, have a great weekend, everybody. Enjoy. Have some fun this weekend. Enjoy your friends and loved ones. And I will see you next Friday, same time, same place. Sam Rejofsky, Sam Nation, over and out.